Since it's 8:07, I think we should get started. I think we've got a very interesting panel coming up. Just one housekeeping note. For regular cleaning of aluminum utensils, hot water and a neutral soap are advised. Very fine steel wool, which can be bought in packets, is useful for removing any discoloration. A weak solution of vinegar heated in the saucepan will also remove tarnish. Before we begin, in the spirit of net neutrality, I'm compelled to remind everyone that any reuse, rebroadcast, retransmission of this panel's findings, its transcripts, or its webcast without the express written permission of your internet service provider is strictly prohibited. I'd like to introduce our panelists. First, I'm going to, the dog that's not going to bark is John Thorne. John has a ringside seat at the Qualcomm-Broadcom battle going on now, and he has left a statement that I will at some point try to get into the proceedings. Let me introduce Peter Huber, Paul McWilliams, Todd Cohen, Andy Kessler, Professor Lawrence Lessig, and George Gilder. And I think without any further ado, I'd like to start with Professor Lessig. What do you mean by net neutrality? What's wrong with the way things are today? Why do we need to change the law?
Well, net neutrality is exactly what George Gilder had been talking about in the early stages of understanding the internet. It is the principle that the network embraces, which some people call the end-to-end principle, some people call the dumb, stupid network principle, but it's a principle that the network is as simple as possible and all the intelligence is at the edge of the network. Now, when the internet was born, there was a legal basis to insist upon that neutrality. There was a technical basis that made that neutrality necessary. You couldn't technically actually do anything different. And there was a very strong norm in the market supporting that neutrality. And because of that neutrality, the explosion of innovation at the applications and content layer happened. Now, right now, the legal basis supporting that neutrality has been erased by the FCC. August 5th, 2005, the FCC abandoned any continuing obligation of neutrality for the network. The technical basis for that neutrality is gone because all the technology companies have now built intelligence back into the network so that the network itself can begin to pick and choose applications and content that will succeed on the network. And the norms supporting neutrality on this network are also eroding. So the original network that exploded innovation in applications and content is now being changed back to exactly the ancient regime which George Gilder taught us how many years ago was the failure in the potential for network policy. So all that net neutrality is, in my view, is a very thin layer of regulation, returning much less regulation than we had all the way through the history of the internet until August 5th, 2005, that simply requires that there is not what I call well, that there's not discrimination in actually how you make your content available to different equivalent kinds of products. So I don't have any problem if Verizon wants to say to me, if I want 100 megabits per second, I can dream for a second, but if I want 100 megabits per second symmetrical, I've got to pay 100 bucks a month. And if you want just 1 megabit, you can pay just 25 bucks a month. I don't care about consumer tiering, but I do care about tiering at the level of particular companies. So if you say to YouTube, if you want high quality video, you've got to pay this price, and Google, you've got to pay this price for high quality video, and the prices are different between them, that creates the opportunity for the existing powerful network operators and existing companies to protect themselves against the competition that has made the internet exactly the source of competition it is.
Paul, do you have a response?
Just real quickly, Commissioner Martin of the FCC said the following in a Q&A period, Q&A during a conference. I do think the commission has the authority necessary to enforce network neutrality violations, noting that the FCC has in fact done that in the case of Madison River's blocking of Vonage VoIP. The commissioner of the FTC said something very, very similar at the Aspen meeting last August in a quite a bit longer statement.
Yeah, the premise under which Madison River was prosecuted was removed on August 5th, 2005. So the commissioner believes that there's residual jurisdiction, but at the same time constantly talks about the unwillingness to actually exercise the jurisdiction or the need to exercise the jurisdiction. And what's the consequence? I mean, I wish Bob Woodward would move on to an interesting subject. I mean, here's where there's a state of denial, right? We have absolutely the worst broadband policy imaginable, and it's just not theory, not a bunch of academics waving their hands in the air like this. It's facts. We have digressed in our broadband position across relative to the rest of the world in the last six, I think, 8 years, and I think primarily because of this policy.
I agree with you. I think we need less regulation, not more, I think is the point where we might disagree. Now, what in House Resolution 5252, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't actually have that before me. I don't know. I don't actually spend time in D.C.
What is it?
House Resolution 5252 is a net neutrality bill like Senate Bill 2917. House Resolution 5252, do we have that slide available that goes through the nine covenants of the Consumer Bill of Right, essentially? Internet Bill of Right? Save me popping through them. There we go. This is H.R. 5252. And I've spoken with executives at Verizon, at Comcast, and at AT&T, and none of them object to any of these. As a matter of fact, Whitaker, who kind of opened the can of worms last October with an off-the-cuff statement, corrected himself more recently. He said, any provider who blocks access to the internet is inviting customers to find another provider. Whitaker said at his keynote speech. It had, it's bad business. He then emphatically stated that AT&T would not block independent services, nor would it degrade internet access, period, end of story. Can you respond to that?
Well, you know, it's hard to know what exactly the position is when both sides of the position have been articulated. Okay, but if Whitaker agrees with network neutrality proponents that the owners of the network should not have the authority to pick and choose applications and content that run across the network, either by blocking or preferring.
Isn't that a problem of engineering, not law? The issue, if you don't have enough bandwidth, you got to choose among the various items you transmit across the network. If you have enough bandwidth, then you can transmit anything you want. And in general, the owners of a conduit want everybody's content to go across it. And the owners of content want to go across everybody's conduit. And so the natural dynamics of capitalism in this place, in this situation, favor network neutrality, except on the extraordinary case that which currently obtains to some degree of a Byzantine regulatory structure that has halted for many years investment in broadband in the United States and which is now beginning to give way unless we turn around and enact some new layer of complex, baffling, and endlessly litigious propositions and about network neutrality, which we can't define very well and which applies in different terms all across the network, which renders the cable industry illegal to begin with, so assures some waiver for cable and just creates a brawl in Washington in which the network itself will be the victim. And if the network is the victim, if we don't get more bandwidth, when the 4 petabytes of video sweep down on that network, there's going to have to be all sorts of discrimination everywhere.
Yeah, so you're right. We need to get infinite bandwidth. But what are the policies that are blocking it? What's your view on the auctioning of spectrum in this context.
I know what your view is.
Your view is that all that the FCC should be is licensing radios, not auctioning spectrum. But instead, what we see is increasing amounts of spectrum that could be the competitor in this unlicensed way being bought up by exactly the same people who own the networks to, again, create this context.
I want people to make money on the network. That's what I want. I don't think if we have lawyers and professors attempting to determine the details of the internet, there is not going to be any money made on the internet, and the result will be no. The current investment, which is at last flooding into broadband, will be halted.
It won't be halted
because of some evil conspiracy of former baby bells. It will be halted because the Wall Street will not support broadband. Verizon is has a controversial policy, which is attempting to deploy real broadband, invest $28 billion in a real broadband network in America, and Wall Street is very skeptical. And if further legislation and regulations about making money on the internet are enacted, that broadband deployment will be halted.
Nobody's arguing.
And you'll then have to have network discrimination. You'll have to, you know who will win that battle. It'll be the TV broadcasters in all likelihood.
Nobody's arguing about whether we ought to be making money on the network. In fact, the network I described, the network you described, was a network where the greatest opportunity to make money came from the growth in applications and content. The only issue here is whether the law permits the conduit to exercise its power, which right now it has, to begin to skim some of that potential wealth off for itself, thereby reducing the total wealth of the network in order to increase their own wealth. Now, this is exactly the architecture of the network which you were fighting before. Now, we could talk about whether we want to get it by government regulation or competition or all sorts of other things like that, but what you can't disagree with is the legal premise under which the original network was built is radically changed, gone. The technical
everything changes in the network every couple of years.
I think, Larry, you're referring to the reclassification of internet services as Title I services, first for cable and then for phone companies. Okay, but that is of course not the legal premise on which most of the internet was built. Most of the dollars in the internet, of the broadband internet today, were not built under Title II. They were not. They actually were not. That is an empirical fact, and I'm going to tell you why, because I know where those dollars went, and I'll tell you how, under what title they got built. But let me start by quoting from somebody who thought he knew something about this. Some time ago, there was a restructuring of a core piece of pricing in the internet. In fact, the most expensive parts of the internet at that time, the broadband internet at that time. The prices were radically restructured, and it was very controversial at the time. It was a big brouhaha, and this fellow who thought he knew what he was talking about was responding to the critics, because he was in favor of this pricing restructuring. And I quote, he said, "They, the critics, assume anything different will be disastrous, but there has to be willingness to explore alternatives rather than to stick with someone else paid for it before and I don't want to pay for it now." Okay? He went on with one of his nice metaphors, "It is often misunderstood by observers that peering is somehow cost-free. Nothing could be more untrue." Now, you know who that was? That was Vinton Cerf. And you know what he was talking about? 10 years ago in 1997, when he talked about that, there was only one broadband chunk to the internet, and that was the backbones. Nobody had broadband at the end except very, very large customers who were buying private lines. For years, until 1997, your whole heyday of the internet, the backbones just peered with each other. There were only a couple of backbones. There was a very limited backbone, and they peered. They just handed off traffic to each other. You take mine, I'll take yours. And it was economically unsustainable. It could not last. And we all know why it couldn't last, because there were lots of little providers at the end who just wanted to funnel traffic into the backbone, and if they could peer with the big guys, nobody would pay for the backbone. Somebody had to pay for the backbone. All of the relationships between the backbone, and that's true to this day, by the way, all of the relationships between the broadband backbone of the network and the smaller guys who feed traffic into the backbone are Title I contracts. None of them are common carriage. All are privately negotiated, every single one. None of it, not one piece of it, is under this premise you say got reversed in 2005.
Yeah,
it's not so. And just a second. And The backbone guys simply announced unilaterally one day, we ain't doing this anymore. You're a little guy at the edges. We'll negotiate a contract with you. Yahoo can negotiate. Google can negotiate. eBay can negotiate. You want something into our pipe. Verizon, if you're feeding locally, can negotiate into our pipe. This was before Verizon had acquired MCI. And we'll work out a contract. By the way, there was a lot of arguing about this. Vinton Cerf was on the side saying, it's nuts. We won't get any money unless we change our pricing structure. And all of the handoffs inside this network, all of the highest broadest bandwidth components of the network today are Title I components. And by the way, since that change occurred in the last 10 years, the number of backbones has increased. We've got about 4 more. I mean, there's been a huge investment in that area. Things have done just fine.
Peter,
this is a myth, you know, that it was all kind of Title II regulation. None of it was Title II. Virtually none of the broadband network was Title II. You've made that up, Larry. Dial-up network was Title II. None of the broadband network was ever, for any significant amount of time, Title II.
Peter,
just wasn't.
The whole debate about network neutrality is last mile, not backbone. It's irrelevant, that part of the debate, to this issue of whether we're going to have actual competition in the provision of broadband the last mile.
No, it's not.
And at the last mile.
No, because what you want to outlaw is Verizon's contract with Netflix.
No.
Wait, hold on. Larry, a moment ago, and I wrote it down to be careful, you said you don't mind if Verizon negotiates with you or charges you a different price for 100 megabit per second connection, okay? What you don't want, and I'm quoting, you're okay with this consumer level tiering, but you don't want, and I'm quoting you exactly, particular companies to be charged different amounts. Now, first of all, you've created a dichotomy that does not exist in the internet, which is that there's a world of consumers, peons, me, you, okay, and there's a world of particular companies. Boy, that's redolent of the 1930s. You have this vision of, you know, Google and eBay and big guys up there, and then, you know, that's not what the internet's about at all. What you want to outlaw, what your law thing out there outlaws, is Verizon not going to me. They already go to me and say, you want Huber, you want 600 kilobits, you want a megabit, you want 5, here are the different prices, and I happily pay the difference. That's already lawful, and you have written that you're in favor. You don't want Verizon to go to Netflix and say, look, 100 megabit per second to Larry Lessig is a meaningless concept. Speeds don't exist at a point in network. They're end-to-end speeds. It's nonsense to talk of 100 megs to Larry Lessig. Larry Lessig wants 100 megs to Netflix, and that's what you want to outlaw. You do not want Verizon to be able to go to Netflix and say, look, we've got 30 million customers here, and we can, you know, we got to prioritize traffic at every switching point. We've got to put one packet earlier, another later. You know, what's it worth to you? We can invest more. We can route your traffic preferentially. We can do that. That's what you want to outlaw.
Yeah, I know exactly what I want. And you're right. I want to outlaw what I would call access tiering. And here's why. On everybody's table is this story of YouTube. Right? YouTube, this upstart video provider. If we had lived in the world that at least Whitaker described before his press people told him it was a stupid thing to be describing the world like that, then how would YouTube have competed against the obvious competitor to YouTube, which is Google Video? YouTube and Google Video both would have been told by the carriers, you want good access to our content, you're going to have to pay this access tax. The people who would have been able to pay the access tax are the incumbents, the upstarts, which is the definition of a competition in the
internet. Larry, do you know how YouTube connects to the web today? Do you know how they connect? Under what? What regulatory regime did they connect under YouTube? Because I actually know. Do you know? What is their connection to the web today? Do you know? Have you checked? If you haven't, go look.
There is no relevant difference in the connection to the web. That's the
you
whole
bet
point
your
about
life
what
there is. You think they're doing a dial-up a DSL at 1.6 gigs? YouTube? You think eBay has got? You think the eBay has a DSL line to the web? Every one of them is a Title I contract today. They're all negotiated contracts.
But again, Peter, a totally irrelevant point about what's happening at the backbone or the core of the network versus how people are going to be having access to the last mile of the network. But my point, which you are diverting from as you sort of interrupted from what I was saying, my point was, in a competitive environment where the relatively small number of competitors get to say, if you want access to the network, you have to pay the access tax, that's going to obviously impose a burden on upstarts outside of the incumbents. So if you're investing, if you're a venture capitalist investing in this upstart, you're going to say, oh, well, between Google Video and YouTube, I know which one we should be investing in, or I know which one we shouldn't be investing in, because how is it ever going to be that Google could lose to this upstart, given that there's this tax? You want to turn the internet into the cell phone network. That's theory of what the network is. It's no longer bell heads, it's cell heads. And you want to talk about application competition in the cell phone network? You talk to venture capitalists like, it's impossible to innovate in the cell phone network. Why? Because the gatekeepers are all Clay Christensen's nightmare. They have the most unbelievable innovator's dilemma mentality, and they get to choose what runs on that platform. You want to create that in the internet, and what you'll produce is an internet that's much less valuable, much less money made, much less economically important than the internet we could produce if the values you talk about actually continue to be part of the network.
And it's not limited to bandwidth. Remember, because George talked about bandwidth as being the restrictor. But if you look at the cell phone network, they're not limiting your choices and application choices based on bandwidth. They're doing it based on how they can maximize their profit. So we see that in the SMS short codes. We see that with them granting SMS short codes to the Red Cross and United Way. Why? There's no money to be made from them. There's a potential liability issue. But even better, why should they have that? Do you need to go and get permission? And it may be controversial and it may be political. So the decision Verizon Wireless makes, both on the wireless application side and also on the SMS codes, is to say, you know what? We're not going to do any of those unless you come and ask for permission. I'd extend the metaphor more so not from the cellular world, which we see is happening now, but also the cable TV world. Is there more innovation in the e-commerce space, in the cable TV world? In the cable TV home, the cable TV e-commerce world is Home Shopping Network and QVC. Is that a better model than the internet e-commerce world? Between eBay, Google Ad Networks, Google AdSense, between all of the small players that choose to participate and don't have to get permission, where the cable TV world, you're either on QVC or you're on the Home Shopping Network, or you're not able to provide. Because that's the point of who is making the determination. Who is the one who's saying, I'm going to grant you the right to ride across my network?
Now, let us actually talk about what is done today, because that matters as a starting point. What was being done 3 years ago? I'll tell you how eBay, since it's your company, and if you wish to correct me, go right ahead, is connecting to the network today. They are not buying Title II, common carriage, network neutrality connections. That would be preposterous. Every one of them is buying private high-capacity pipes. I'll tell you what Google does beyond that. I don't know. eBay almost certainly the same. Google is actually building store centers all across the country. They started with one. They built 12 by putting huge caching systems all over the country. Of course, you bypass large parts of the network. I suspect eBay is either doing the same or using Akamai or one of the store with people. And so you bypass a lot of the. So today, at the high end, at the company end, you have no network neutrality. Every one of your connections, if you're a large provider, is a contract negotiated connection. You're probably running your own fiber if you're big enough. You're going through. So you know, at my end, Larry and everybody agrees we can have tiered service. So what exactly are we trying to outlaw? And I know what we're trying to outlaw. And let's face it, we are trying to outlaw any contract that would say, look, if there's scarcity, if there's prioritizing, if there's anything that has to be done in the network to differentiate what are in fact differentiated services, and I want to finish this point because it's crucial, okay? The big carriers cannot contract with the people who need the high throughput. Now look, there's a huge fallacy in what's written in the Senate bill and what Larry argues. Larry, you know, has this religion about, gee, the conception of the net was this and that and the next thing. Now let's talk the real world. Data services and voice services and video services are quite different in terms of what's needed, okay? Data is a forgiving kind of stuff. You can cache it. You can suffer temporary interruptions. You know, if your email has a quarter second glitch in it, you know, you may notice, you may not. It'll matter over time, it adds up. You cannot watch an action movie with a quarter second glitch in it, okay? Because it ruins the movie, okay? I mean, a second glitch and you walk out of the theater, right? It just is, something interesting might be happening, right? During that second, and ruins the whole effect. Voice, you cannot have a two-way voice conversation with delays. It's crummy, okay? There's a powerful economic and service-related reason to say not all bits are equal. Some people need high throughput and will pay for it. Netflix can send you a disc through the mail. They can cache it on your system if they have to go that way, or they can pay for three throughput. We should allow the money and the people who want to buy that service to pay for it. That's how you get things built.
But Peter, you're
this
a smart
bill
guy.
Will actually
you know,
outlaw that.
Peter, okay? You know you're a smart guy. You know that's not what I'm arguing against.
I know what that's written on
okay,
up there because I know
what
those
that.
Words mean.
You put me with that. And
well,
you know
well,
that,
that's what I'm. Like, then Larry's on my no. side too, but we're both against that.
No. Telecosm, page 205. The old players are singing the song of the siren. That's exactly what you're saying. We've got different kinds of functionality. We need to build different networks. We allow the network controllers to begin to build different networks on the basis of that functionality. Now, I don't disagree with you that video providers ought to be able to say, if you want video quality service, here's the price. And if you want web quality service, here's the price. I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have is them saying, if you, Google, want web quality video quality service, here's the price, and here's the problem to YouTube. And the reason that's a problem is that we have an opportunity right now for them to use their monopoly power at one end of the network to skew development of applications and content to the network. You keep on talking about the backbone. I agree with George. If we had effectively infinite capacity and we had a competitive market, which we do effectively with the backbone, and we have a competitive market with caching, there wouldn't be a problem here. But the whole point is that we've got a network where 98% of the broadband is being carried by two methods, and this duopoly that exists basically everywhere in the country has a business model before them. How do we begin to extract rents? So that we, like the cable companies, we, like the cell phone companies, begin to take some of this wealth to ourselves. And the consequence of that is the same as it always is, less wealth for the economy as a whole.
And the cell phone example is a very good example of how limited bandwidth results in restrictions. This is an engineering problem that the cell phones face. They have limited bandwidth in their areas, so they naturally have to restrict access in all sorts of ways. And as wireless bandwidth expands, there'll be more and more network neutrality from your point of view.
If that's
the
true, why?
The key point is expanding bandwidth.
Why aren't they arguing?
And it won't happen if you let the politicians and lawyers back in the midst of the network. That's
but George,
all.
George, if that's true, why aren't they arguing for totally unlicensed spectrum?
Well,
you and I both know that will increase capacity, right?
This because the technologies have all been developed for and optimized for licensed spectrum. It's a complicated thing to create all the new technologies that make it possible to all the software radios and everything that make it possible to have truly unlicensed access to spectrum. I hope that happens. Experiments are being conducted today with the ISM bands and a whole set of new bands, and there's going to be lots of experimentation with unlicensed spectrum. But if you're handling billions and billions of phone calls and other internet access from mobile uses, it helps to have control of the spectrum.
This
today
is not a technical point, it's a business model point. Right. They fight the unlimited spectrum you would like the world to see because it's harder to make money in the world of unlimited spectrum for them. They are pushing to increase the capacity for them to control broadband access, whether it's spectrum or wires. And both of those are about producing exactly the market that you should be opposing, a market where the network itself is exercising control over the innovation. Telecosm, page 199, right? Intelligence in the network actively impedes innovation. Yet that's exactly the architecture they're pushing, both at the spectrum level
there's a battle, and the two architectures are, this whole conference is about that battle, and we had a great speech last night by Terry Turpin about why the all optical dumb network, it will ultimately prevail. There are other people who have other views. It's a fascinating technical issue. It's not a legal issue. As a matter of fact, regulations do not help resolve that issue.
Hey, George, it's about halfway in and the coffee's finally kicking in and I need to say something here.
Yeah.
And that is that this is the stupidest argument I've ever heard from both sides. It appears that there's a town where there's one gas station. And there's no gas shortage or oil shortage. The backbone is, you know, private contracts, and so the oil is flowing. But this one gas station is limiting how much gas there is available to this town. And one group wants the gas to be available to everyone at the same price. You know, if you pay more, you get more gas, but the same amount per gas. While the other group says, well, wait a second, you know, we got businessmen here that have delivery services. They should be able to pay more for gas, and then we've got carpoolers, and then we got these hot rodders like you two, right, that have that want to just blow the gas on frivolous things. And so, should we regulate it? You know, yes, you know, let's keep it equal for everyone. You could pay more, you could pay less. Or, oh, no, you know, let's try to charge more for, you know, the vans delivering flowers. When the we could argue that all day. How do we mold that limited gas / bandwidth? Or put another gas station across the street, or another one, a third one on the other corner, and a fourth one on the other corner. And so when I look at this issue, it's merely, is the net neutrality going to bring me more competition, or is the hijacking monopolist plumber putting a toll booth up going to bring me more competition? And I'm not convinced that either one is. I agree that we shouldn't have more regulation, because regulations are just about loopholes, right? Well, yeah, let's have network neutrality, but, you know, campaign packets, they get through first, right? So, you know, Congress always needs their little thing. And the first responders, their pack, and then all of a sudden you've got this hodgepodge of thing that never works, and we'll never have hot rodders. Similarly, those that want to be able to charge more for services, I wouldn't mind paying more for a Netflix-like thing rather than have to go to the damn post office to return my DVDs, but not if the argument by the telcos and cable guys is, you know, give me that regulation that I can charge more, and then I'll build the network. Where you know, we have a history in technology where Cisco spends a $1 billion or more to build their next router well before they even have a customer for it. And Intel spends billions on their processors well before they have a customer for it. And so I like what Verizon's doing, building it out. Unfortunately, they're not so much doing it for internet access, I don't think, as they are to deliver Animal Planet to more people and overcharge for that. But this is one of those arguments where both sides are off their rocker, and the answer is outside of this box.
But Andy, no one on this stage has said that we ought to have same price for everything, right? I mean, you know, it's a nice argument. I've seen it written up too, but it has nothing to do with the actual argument that's going on this stage, right? Nobody's talking about universal, flat. That board is not talking, Peter. That board is just up there. I can't even read what it says up there.
What does non-discriminatory mean to you? It's a term of art. It's been used in common carrier regulation for 70 years. All right. What does that mean to you, Larry? What does reasonable mean to you? There are thousands pages in the CFR defining those words. All right.
Yeah. I mean,
what does reasonable mean, Peter?
Well, reasonable means the FCC's got to say if the price is right. Non-discriminatory means they've got to say if A equals B, you've got to charge them the same, but if A does not equal C, you can charge a different price. And believe me, in Washington, we get really rich working out the meaning.
What Andy said, which is absolutely right, is we have to make clear there are two separate issues going on here. One is the argument about what do we do to increase the penetration of bandwidth in the world. That's about how do we make the physical network actually much more effective. The other is, what do we do to make sure that we continue to have application and content competition? And the conflict between the network neutrality people and the other side is that we, network neutrality people, think application and content competition is where all the growth is. And if you have to sell the soul of the internet, giving up the kind of robust application and content competition in order to get more bandwidth, more physical infrastructure, then you're losing more than you're gaining. But we can focus on this question of how do you get more, gas stations built. And this is where the state of denial of broadband policy in America has got to become known to people like you. Every other country that's succeeding is succeeding by following exactly the kind of regulatory policies that are being opposed right here. In Europe right now, if you look at penetration, None of us is arguing for open access, except the last time Peter and I worked together, we were working together on briefs to support open access. But we're way beyond open access, because I think it's too heavy a regulatory burden. But if you look at Europe right now, two and a half times penetration of countries where there is open access regulation in local loop is 2.5 times versus countries where there's not. Every single dimension of open access regulation, you actually see much broader penetration than in countries where they're not. Now, people say this is because of density. There's no economic support because it's because of density. The only thing that's explaining the radically better fact of broadband access in countries like France, for example, I mean, God, that France can offer broadband we're 6 times in the bandwidth per than France. The fact that they can do that versus us is not a function of anything other than a different environment of the competition.
We agree, and the reason is they have simple. There is simple. Communications regulations compared to us, where we have a different regulatory regime in each of 50 states, and we have a massive mesh of further regulatory regimes in Washington, and the combination has produced paralysis, or did for many years. This paralysis is at last breaking up, and the network neutrality people come in and want to overlay yet a new set of price controls and price caps and mandates and regulations and special rules, all of which will be litigated for another 10 years of paralysis.
I feel like I'm in Times Square and I've got some shells in front of me, Larry. Look, in France, you said the penetration for the end user broadband is higher in France, but you don't have a problem.
No, I didn't say that. I said the price in the United States in the broadband per megabit is 6 times the offer in France right now. The growth rate in France was higher than the United States, but the actual penetration is lower. We are 16th in penetration. France is below us.
Interestingly enough, what we came here to debate this morning and what you said in your opening comments does not address discrimination or prices at the end user end. What we are talking about, this debate is about protecting Google, eBay, the large data providers from discrimination by Verizon and AT&T. Now, last time I checked, those guys weren't all located in Gay Paris, okay? They somehow seem to be doing fine here, all of them under Title I contracts. Not one of them is protected by the law you want to enact now.
Who introduced the question of how do we get good broadband penetration. That's what I was responding to there. But you're just wrong when you say this is about protecting Google. Google, I think, is making a big mistake from its own corporate perspective in fighting to defend network neutrality, because Google would be in a great position to buy its permanence as the leader in this position if every competitor to Google had to pay the access tax, because Google can afford it and they can't. So this is not about protecting Google. It's about protecting the YouTubes that are eating Google's lunch in many contexts of competition. An amazing fact, the only area where Google is losing in competition. And it's because of the platform of neutrality and keeping the options to innovate open that's possible. That's what this debate is about.
So you want to change the law? I mean, why do we need more law if YouTube has risen up under the existing regime?
George, the law has been changing. The deregulation strategy has been the strategy since 1998, and it finally had its complete finish in August 5th, 2005. So the law has been changing. Deregulation has been happening. Now, in the context of this law changing, we've been falling behind in broadband penetration. So, you know, I'm not going to make the fallacious sort of cause effect here, but at least we should wake up to the fact that this deregulation argument is just a fallacy, George. The internet arose in the last mile context under a very strict regime of regulation. But for the breakup and all the neutrality regulations AT&T lived under, there wouldn't have been an internet. It was because people were free to plug things into the telephone network, and AT&T couldn't tell you, no, you're not allowed to run that unless you're a business.
Let's go back and talk about the AT&T regime. That's very relevant. I mean,
Please.
This is history, Larry. This is There's no danger of a restoration of the AT&T regime in this dynamic industry unless the government takes it over and imposes a new level of price caps, which essentially favor competition as long as nobody wins or makes any money.
Yeah, it's a slogan, George, it's a slogan. It has nothing to do with the reality here, right? The reality of what this battle is about is, you're right, about regulation. So spectrum regulation. One of the biggest problems here, and you should agree with this, is spectrum regulation. The fact that they have gotten regulations that give them exclusive rights in the context of the use of spectrum. That's as much regulation as anything is.
They pay for it.
Well, of course they pay for it, but everybody pays for regulation. That's called lobbying, right? So it's not any different from...
They paid for the spectrum.
Of course they did, but the question is whether that system of regulation, which is locking up spectrum in these exclusive licenses, is actually the most efficient system for using spectrum for wealth. And you're, at least the George Gilder I read, said, no, it's not. It's actually...
I agree in principle with your point. I don't think it's relevant to this particular debate here. We can discuss it afterwards. I'm perfectly delighted to discuss spectrum policy and all the intricacies of it, which actually are more engineering problems than they are legal problems. Believe it or not, the real issues in supplying wireless access are still engineering issues. Bandwidth is scarce in the wireless domain.
Only because of the way it's architected. And it's architected not just because of a technical issue, but because of a business issue. You say you don't want to talk about it, but you say that I'm all for regulation. Well, I'm just saying there's regulation going all over this debate. And so you want to talk about my regulation at a very thin layer to, you know, basically everybody agrees about four things in the network neutrality debate. That's Powell's four freedoms. Yeah. We all agree about that. I'm talking about one more layer.
What do we all agree about?
Well, at least every single bill that was out there was supporting Powell's four freedoms in the context of it. Even those things that were not network neutrality bills were endorsing that, Powell's four freedoms, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's only one additional layer, and that's what I call access
tiering. Okay, if everyone agrees with something, what's Powell's four freedoms?
Well, you can go back to the other slide that listed the first four of those, which were you can't discriminate in content, you can't discriminate, can't block content, can't block applications, got to have access to information about how exactly the network's used, and you can't stop people from putting new applications on content.
All this depends on building out the broadband network. All those four freedoms, they will be denied if the network is not built out. They will flourish if the network's built out. So the question is how you create investment incentives for actually building these vastly expensive fiber and wireless networks all across the country. That's what matters. And if more pretexts for price controls and regulations are established, I guarantee that this bandwidth will not be supplied. That's all there is to it. We still have these 50 states. Some of them are beginning to break down on franchise rules and are beginning to favor the rollout of bandwidth. And here you come in and you say you want network neutrality, but everything you're proposing would stop network neutrality by complicating the investment process, by demoralizing Wall Street's willingness to support the companies that are building it.
I would agree if after August 5th, 2005, when the limitations were lifted...
I don't even know what happened. August 5th, 2005. I didn't notice. What happened?
The DSL regulations were lifted, and no longer did they have to weren't subject any longer to Title II. So that our friends at AT&T and Verizon could then start discriminating across on the access side. But they didn't make a change in their investment portfolios. They made the same investments on rolling out broadband on August 4th, when they were in the, quote, regulated regime, as they did on August 6th.
No, the investments have been steadily expanding and, massively expanding. You've got the figures up there about Verizon and AT&T's investments in this.
They would have gone up either way. They were already in the works. And it was the only difference was is that Ed Whitaker was honest enough to say, now I can take rents. That was the change.
Now you can do what?
He could take rents. And technically, you still have another year for at least AT&T with its SBC merger, and so it's October 2007 that really does matter, because then the limitations on the SBC-AT&T merger are ending and the MCI-Verizon limitations are over. But I know what a world is like without network neutrality, and that's the Chinese internet. And that's where you do have a government that has decided that they're going to pick and choose what applications are going to go through. And that's what we're opposed to. So when Larry talks about, well, we're in the wrong position, that he says Google's in the wrong position of taking, that they should be supporting the anti-network neutrality regime, we still believe, at least at eBay, that at least in our three business models, both Skype, PayPal, and eBay, we have a better chance long-term if we don't have to go and ask for permission. And that's not just limited to the domestic market here in the U.S., but worldwide. And the U.S. market will have a leadership position on how other countries treat the internet also. And if you want a balkanized internet, go to China and find out what it's like.
You know, since we're talking August 5th, 2005, before August 5th, 2005, in this duopoly of and providers, right, there was duopoly such as was there before as well as after. There were the cable companies and the phone companies, right, the cable. Now, one of them was not under Title II, okay? The cable companies had been gotten out of that a good year or two earlier, okay? They were never formally under it. They fought it all along. Said they were never under it. I might add, they also had 65% of the market. They had pushed out, they had signed up a lot more people. Everybody, including many people in this room, said, forget the dumb old bells, who were, by the way, fully regulated under this wonderful, you know, taming regime that would make them good guys and make YouTube possible and all that. Everybody said, forget them, they're not doing anything, they're hopeless. Cable's going to deliver. Cable was delivering. They were moving, they were widening the gap on broadband, okay? As of last August, it was everybody had known it was coming for ages. It was impossible to say two identical services provided side by side by two wires running over the same poles are going to continue to operate under two different regulatory regimes, very different regulatory regimes. I mean, radically different. One is Title I, one's Title II. And so they kicked it off for the phone companies. This affected only the end user, the consumer, who is not affected by this bill, because this bill, in hundreds of pages of fine print, actually divides the world between big, important people like eBay and Google and Netflix and so on, and consumers. Now, you know what? I might get interested in uploading video someday. I have a nice digital camera. Who knows? I might make some money out of it, right? Sounding off against Larry or who knows what. There's a possibility, right? And guess what? You know what? 100 lawyers later and 5 years of litigation later, we will work out just when I'll be big enough, you know, to reach the point where Verizon can't say, Huber, you want 100 megabits? Well, guess what, you know? We can't negotiate with you because this law's been passed.
Yeah. Why don't we have a question from the audience?
Should we get some, actually, Elaine Patterson, are you out here?
Yeah. I have one question. Elaine Patterson from Equinix. We're the place where all of these Title I contracts get physically implemented. So one question I have, I spend a lot more time talking to network architects than I do to politicians. And I noticed that disk storage is growing about 10 times faster than the network can keep up. And I talked to a lot of people talking about business models, about video central offices and things like that. So is an RBOC-owned kind of CDN model or streaming replication model that gets then rented out to content companies a net neutrality violation?
No, absolutely not. Because the only concern network neutrality focuses on is the part of the market where there's not actually sufficient competition. There's, of course, an advantage that eBay and Google have because they have very fast caching servers located all over the world. So their actual ability to serve content effectively is better than their competitors. But that's exactly the kind of preference that we ought to be encouraging in a competitive market, because they're investing in a competitive space, caching space, and they're actually producing a better product. That's perfect. That's what the market ought to be encouraging. The only place network neutrality is concerned is the place that Peter would have us just ignore, the last mile space, where in fact right now there isn't sufficient competition, and there's less today than there was 6 years ago. So network neutrality is not affected, in my view, by what you attach in the effective backbone of the network to make your products actually better products than your competitors.
Under that law, as written, if Verizon deploys a huge caching server all through its region and then goes to Netflix and says, you want to cache on my my storage centers all right near the customer so I can give you guaranteed throughput, they will be in violation of that law. I guarantee you. I know how to read that law. That's what it says. You'd have to have other providers, non-Verizon, but anyone affiliated with Verizon could not do it. Clear as day. No question. Illegal if Verizon does it.
Well, next time you should invite the law up here to defend itself, but nobody's defending that position.
Okay, fine. Well, then, as long as Larry and I are both against this law,
when you go to Washington, Larry, that's what you get. You get that kind of stuff, and that's just the first step. Wait till it ends. Wait till the process ends.
Yeah, but George, again, there's this process that's going all over the place. You begin to block, so the number, the amount of spectrum available for unlicensed uses has dropped 25% in the last 6 years. 25%. The space that you think
there's about to be a huge new allocation. I don't agree with that.
But that's regulation two. That's the point. And then the telecom companies go out and they start passing state laws to block the ability of local municipalities from offering wireless competitive services. Right. You'd be against that too, right? Yes. So there's regulation all over the place here. It's not like I'm calling for regulation and there's no regulation on the other side.
Andy, maybe you should have the last word. We got about a minute.
Hands?
Oh, we got.
Can we get some more questions, do you think? We got four.
Right. Yeah, and Russell Redenbach, hi, Russ. Andy, maybe you can help us out here. This is far too confusing a conversation for me. It seems the simple question is there is a scarce resource. You want price to allocate it, or politicians? Could you just speak to that? Because all this other stuff is way too confusing.
Yeah, well, Larry said it. We pay six times more than the Europeans, and nothing in the U.S. should ever be more expensive than Europe. I mean, food, hotels, wine, everything else, clothes. So the question is, why is that? And it's not only that they pay less, but they can get 10 megs for 10 euro. I can't get 10 megs at my house. And I think the reason I can't get 10 megs is even though I dumped DSL a long time ago and have a cable modem, if somehow I can get 10 megs and there really was net neutrality and I could start feeding real standard definition video in and start watching football games or cable channels through internet access, then all of a sudden I don't pay Comcast for the rest of the crap that they throw at me for 50, 60, 80 bucks a month. And so I see this vast conspiracy to limit bandwidth by the telephone companies because they have competition from voice over IP and from cable companies to limit video bandwidth. And I think that has as much to do with keeping a lid on things. And so what I'd like to see, this is all, you get network neutrality for free with competition. If you have competition, there will never hear the word network neutrality again. Because if someone, chokes the network off for some player, then the third or the fourth or the fifth guy who offers, internet access unencumbered, all the customers will go over that way. And so I that's why I say this is a stupid argument. You'll get network neutrality for free. The question is who's playing games to limit bandwidth for not Google and not Verizon, but us, the consumers. We're the ones that are paying for all this crap, and it's a tax on the stupid to pay six times more than the Europeans.
Hans, one more question, I think.
Thank you. Hans Haney with the Discovery Institute, and I have a hypothetical. Online advertising generated $12.5 billion last year, and that was a 30% increase over the previous year, and all indications are it's going to continue to grow rapidly. Now, my hypothetical is this. Let's say that it's illegal to block or degrade another website or another application or another service, but that's it. So does anyone think there would be anything wrong if AT&T and Verizon decided to hold an auction whereby MSN, Yahoo, and Google could bid for the right to have their search bar featured somewhere on the screen? Let's say Verizon and AT&T wanted to build their own portal or have their own browser for their customers. And that would be the featured search bar. Now, a customer could access any of the others by typing www.yahoo.com. But let's say Google pays AT&T $1 billion to feature its search bar on the screen. So in other words, advertising would be supporting both content and delivery. And does anyone have an objection to that?
I don't. totally fine. It's end-to-end competition. That's exactly what we should be encouraging.
Google is building a Wi-Fi network in San Francisco, and the lowest tier, as I last read the news reports, is supposed to be all advertiser-funded. I know how to read a statute. It's illegal. All right. If that thing becomes law, it's illegal. They're giving preferential access to one advertiser. Okay. They're not. That advertiser gets its content in, nobody else does, and they're using that to pay to transport to the homes of San Francisco. It cannot be done under that law.
We've got to move on.
Thank you, panel.
Don't wait.
What's that? 45 seconds.
Thank you very much, Larry, for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you,
George. You made a lot of points.
That was pretty good for somebody who wasn't going to talk. Steve Goldman. Is he here? Mary? Yeah, is he here? All right, our I think we should just move right along here. We're almost on schedule. What's impeding digital power? Our next speaker is Steve Goldman, chairman of the board of Power One. Steve?
I think I'll wait just a couple of minutes till people settle down. I think I'm going to go ahead and start because I think I'm losing more people than gaining. All right, I'm going to start this talk with just about a 3 or 4 minute discussion on Power One because there's been some new news that's come out about our company in the last 3 or 4 days. I'd like to bring everyone up to speed on that. First, just a very quick background on Power One, what we do. We basically build communications power conversion product for telecom infrastructure and industrial equipment. We provide AC to DC products at the system level, DC to DC products at the board level, and silicon digital power management products for the circuit board. Power One's been in business for about 30 years. We're one of the top global power supply companies in the industry. We've completed 5 acquisitions since 1999, and a 6th one we just announced a couple of days ago that I want to talk about. We have a highly automated worldwide manufacturing, strong balance sheet. Our revenues are about $300 million. They will be $530 to $550 million next year with this acquisition. We've been investing about $7 million a year, most recently in silicon. We've actually invested quite a bit more than that in the past for digital power management. And today, Power One's really one of the leading technology players in the industry. We've been a consolidator and a developer of digital power management. We announced a couple of days ago that we signed a definitive agreement to purchase the power electronics group of Magnatec. This increases our revenue by about 50%. We paid about half times next year's sales. And what we believe will get synergies of about $9 million or 10 cents a share in 2007, or $20 million of synergy or 22 cents a share in 2008. So it's a very significant acquisition, and it actually becomes accretive without synergy in the first quarter of next year. So it's a very exciting addition to our portfolio. Also, Magnatec's products ranged from smart motor controllers using digital technology all the way to 50 kilowatt inverters. 90% of their products were digital implementations using microprocessors or digital signal processors. And it augments Power One's Z portfolio products. They also had a little niche business, which is very nice, and we believe will be growing very rapidly over time, which are our power inverters for solar, wind, and fuel cells. These are high density, high reliability inverters. And we believe this will be a very big market, particularly as the cost of fuel goes up and the economics come more into play on these markets. Let's go on to the question of the presentation. What's impeding digital power? Everyone knows Moore's Law. Well, Moore's Law is actually less in analog. And on a digital side, as the die size shrinks roughly 100 to 200% with every generation or every 18 months, there's huge economies as digital technology and line widths go down. And you've heard of, you know, 65 nanometer technologies and so on. The line widths are getting smaller and smaller. The chips are getting smaller and smaller, more density, more functions, and lower cost. On the analog world, Moore's Law doesn't really apply. The die size seems to be shrinking about only 30%, and that's every generation. And generations in analog take between 4 and 8 years. So it's a very, very different world. And so there's a misconception about Moore's Law applying to silicon. It only applies to digital silicon, not analog silicon. Digital power is inevitable, and some of the drivers or what customers want really are at first on the power conversion element. They want higher current, more voltages, lower voltages, and efficiency is a common thread through all customers. Power management is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. Fault management, everyone understands and has read about this latest debacle with the laptop batteries, and laptop batteries burning up. I believe with the proper power management and temperature sensing, that could be prevented. One could sense the temperature of the battery. When it hits a critical level, the AC is cut off. And so that's a basic element of power management that could be fully implemented using digital technology. And my guess is you'll probably see that in the next generation laptops. And of course, efficiency. One of our large server companies, which I can't mention, did a calculation, and we developed a high efficiency power unit for these guys. And based on the efficiency improvement from 89% to 93%, they're going to save $1,400 in electricity per server over 3 years. And essentially, the power supply is free compared to a competing unit just because of the electricity savings. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger deal. And using digital techniques, there's a huge advantage to optimize efficiency. Some of the market drivers to adopt digital power, first of all, on the infrastructure, datacom, and telecom, I just mentioned some concepts. The high availability, including carrier-grade equipment, power data ports, power over Ethernet, energy efficiency, and costs. The level of digital power really goes from the component level to the board level to the system level and to power management. Some of the benefits that customers can achieve really include in the design and emulation of their system. In an analog function, the system is basically fixed. Using digital techniques, they can simulate their system, vary all kinds of parameters under test, and simulate what may happen in the field, and they can do that at virtually no cost. They can achieve real-time monitoring, And it can be a very simple solution. Let's move on. Here's a great comparison of analog versus digital. And let's look at, for example, in at handheld device. Many ICs, many passives. In the software, and using the digital technique, there's very few parts, everything is simple, and we use a GUI interface. From a cost standpoint, in analog, every function has a cost. In the digital world, functions are almost free because you wind up with extra gates on the die, and you can implement additional functions of power management for almost no cost. Limited functionality on the analog world, and again, digital versus virtually unlimited functionality. And then, of course, all the added features, system changes on the fly using digital techniques. This is just a chart come from one of the research companies, I believe this is Darnell Research, that shows the growth in dollars of digital ICs. And these ICs are for control and management and all types of functions and systems. You can see it's still a relatively small number, but it's beginning to go exponential as we move into 08, 09, 2010 and beyond. So digital is moving, and in a couple slides I'm going to maybe give you some insight why it isn't moving even faster. This is what we developed this a few weeks ago, called it the digital power curve. And I have a contrast here of handheld devices or really very small systems versus infrastructure or big equipment. And the first thing that one has to understand is the life cycle of the equipment being developed. If you're developing a small handheld cell phone, you might take 6 months to a year to develop that product and introduce it. You're more likely to introduce new innovative technology because if that model has a flop, you can just introduce a new model 3 months later on. In fact, many companies have models stacked up one after another in case one isn't successful. So by including techniques like digital management in cell phones, which many of them have, there isn't a lot of technical risk because you can do it so quickly and the product life cycles are so fast. Let's contrast that with a gigabit switch, multi-gigabit switch, that may take 3 to 5 years to develop and may have a 5-year life cycle in the field. If someone introduces a new technology in that product and it doesn't work, you've lost a whole generation of products. And these customers tend not to have 3 or 4 new products that they can introduce 2-3 months later. It takes years. So customers in the very high-end systems, although they need digital power management and digital power very much, they're very, very cautious because of the technological risk. Some of the other factors are the overall end product cost, efficiency, and what we're basically predicting is that on some of the small devices, we're going to see a rapid acceptance of digital power, but on some of the big systems, it's going to take a little longer just because of the nature of those products. Disruptive technologies that change the world always have to overcome the inertia of the old. And that's one of the things that we're seeing in digital technology. Another factor is, on this next bullet, the engineers at the customer sites who approve new power and digital technology are analog engineers. All the power engineers in the world are trained from the analog school. Their digital power management, digital power isn't even a topic in universities. So what's interesting, you have the people who are trained in the analog world are the same gatekeepers to approve the digital new technology. And that really causes a drag on that acceptance. When Power One stunned the world with our digital power introduction a few years ago, the first reaction was it doesn't make sense. Analog is here to stay. Well, now a free consortium has banded together called the PM Bus, and eventually came up with a software protocol, but no product. So now the competition is all agreeing that digital power is the way to go. The world is going to go digital, it's a matter of time. And this really was a confusion in the marketplace As Power One introduced these products, digital power was very exciting. We actually spoke at one of these conferences, and then what happened, there was a competing technology which really didn't exist, just a bunch of companies getting together to develop a protocol. So what happened was last year, one of the companies called Artisan introduced a digital point of load regulator, and Power One sued that company. The product never hit the market, and that company actually has since been acquired by Emerson. So we're actually in a legal dispute or litigation with Emerson. Remember, digital power was initially poo-pooed by the industry, and now virtually every competitor or semiconductor company are working on digital power, but there were very few products coming out. And it's unfortunate to say that one of the impediments to the acceptance of digital power is probably Power One because of our IP that I'll show you on the next slide. Another concept I want to just bring to the on the bottom slide here is, I don't know if anyone remembers this technology of DVD minus DVD plus. Raise your hands, anyone who remembers that. Okay, a few of you. Basically, when the DVD burners came out, there was a minus and a plus. And you had to have a certain burner and a certain DVD. And if you made a minus and a plus, it wouldn't play. And very often you'd burn a DVD and you'd put it in your home player and it wouldn't work. Well, customers very much like standardization. And what Power One is now involved in is we have our Z technology, and then there's a PM bus technology. And anytime there are two technologies that are competing, and you're talking about acceptance in the market, it causes a slowdown of acceptance of that technology until one ultimately dominates. And we've seen that happen in many industries. One ultimately dominates, and then the technology winds up taking off and getting accepted. So this is probably one of the biggest barriers in the industry. Power One put together a comprehensive IP portfolio to cover hardware, software, and control. Our technology is now protected by 13 issued patents and 385 claims. This is a very, very broad IP portfolio. Our patent protection has been filed in all major regions of the world. And there's a robust pipeline of additional patents, probably twice the magnitude of what we see now coming through in the future. So this certainly doesn't help the acceptance of a technology. So we believe we have a significant head start. We believe digital power will ultimately win, as it's won in every industry. We have advantages in our system architecture by having simultaneous and synchronous downloading of power and data. We have an architectural advantage. Our products don't require memory at the power. We have memory at the host digital power manager. And we can do things like current sharing and communication between our regulators, not only between the regulator and the system.